You're listening to the Rural Advancement Podcast. Rural Advancement provides resources to empower, equip, and encourage rural pastors and churches. Join our community by visiting us at ruraladvancement.com.
Hello, everybody, and welcome back to Rural Advancement. This is the podcast that is by rural leaders and for rural leaders. It is our goal every single week, week in and week out, to bring you content that is not just spoken to the rural church, but is spoken by people who get it, people who know what it's like to live, work, and minister in small, out-of-the-way places, and people who understand the immense value of the work that God does there. I am your host, Joe Epley, and I am very excited for today's interview. I could probably say that about every interview, but we're about to have a conversation with pastor and author Carl Vaders. And if you go back a few episodes, I reviewed one of his books called Small Church Essentials, and where he talked about just kind of not just the practical tools, but really the structures and the way that we can do church in a small church setting that makes sense. And today we're going to form our conversation around several other of his books and just get to hear his story. And those links will be in the show notes. But first, I want to say, Pastor Carl, how are you doing, sir?
I'm doing well, Joe. It's good to be with you today.
Yeah, well, we're glad to have you. Like I said, I am very excited to dive into our conversation. I have read, I'm going to be honest, 2 2/3 of your books, because I've read the Grasshopper Myth, I've read Desizing the Church, and I am like most of the way through Small Church Essentials. But I'm a big fan of those who can kind of put words to, rural, or even we would say maybe small church experience, and help people have tools to navigate it. And so I'm excited to jump in on that. But first, I just want to hear, you know, we do this all our guests, but I just want to hear some of your story, man. Maybe it's you got saved at a young age or what your ministry journey has looked like, but kind of give us the flyover view. Tell us some of the stops along the way from where you started and what you're doing now, you know?
Yeah, absolutely. I'm actually a third generation Assemblies of God pastor. My grandfather was actually the general superintendent of the Assemblies of God in Newfoundland, Canada for 37 years.
Wow.
My father then was a pastor until just about 15 years ago when he retired. And so I've been a pastor here in California now for 40 plus years. And I got saved when I was just a preacher's kid in a kids ministry meeting. And when the kids ministry guest speaker actually made this point, he said, your parents may be Christians. Your dad might even be a pastor or something, but that doesn't mean you're a Christian. You got to make that decision yourself.
Called you out, really.
Yeah. And it was the first time I'd ever that I'm sure I'd heard it before. It was the first time, if I was 6 or 7, first time it clicked and I went, oh, yeah, I need to do that. I haven't done that yet. And I did it and it stuck. And followed the Lord ever since, and felt the calling into ministry when I was in college. And I spent 40 plus years in pastoral ministry, and all of it in smaller congregations. And for the first 25 years or so pastoring, I didn't know I was a small church pastor. I thought I was a big church pastor that just hadn't gotten there yet.
Sure.
But after 25 years of waiting, you start looking around and going, well, maybe that isn't. But the challenge was, at that season, it was right in the height of the church growth movement, and every voice was telling me, if your church is healthy, it will get bigger. And so I thought, well, if it's not getting bigger, then it must not be healthy, so I must be missing something.
Sure.
And so long story short, I started realizing we really weren't missing anything. Our church was really, really healthy, really strong, really missional. We have a ton of outside-the-walls work that we do, and a ton of impact in our community and around the world, even as a small church. And I started thinking, hey, maybe small isn't a problem to fix. Maybe small is a part of a strategy that God wants to use.
Mm.
And as I started making that shift in perspective, a whole bunch of things came into line for me. So I started writing and speaking about it, and it really registered with a whole lot of pastors, because it's about 90% of churches, therefore 90% of lead pastors are in small congregations, and there are very few voices that are saying thank you to them or that are giving them small church specific resources. So that's what I do now in the ministry of helping small churches thrive.
Yeah. And I know that I've been personally enriched by it just in reading some of these books, but also what a need, for me, similar story, maybe not in that context, but for sure, I have had to grow to love small church and see it as not just an accidental, but an intentional, as something that has its own set of strengths and its own set of things to be managed. And so, it has been so much fun to host a podcast like this, which is again kind of aiming at, how do we function in towns of 98 or towns of 2,000 or towns of 10,000 and or in churches that are just 250 or less or 50 or less and what that looks like. So we're just going to kind of walk through, just pulling different lessons out of your two books. Like I said, people can go back and listen to my review on the Small Church Essentials, but these other two books, Grasshopper Myth, Desizing the Church, really phenomenal tools. I think Desizing the Church is going to mess me up in a good way for a long time. I mean, it just was so well done. Kudos to you. But
Thank you.
we're going to start maybe with a few ideas from the Grasshopper Myth. And a lot of these are just statements or principles to be dissected. And so you kind of take it where you want it. But this first question, you mentioned in this book that people want to be pastored, not spiritually managed, right? Now, what's the difference, and why is this understanding so important in a small church?
Yeah, it's a great question, and it's a very interesting concept for us to consider because in my lifetime we have been through three waves, and I talk about this in Desizing, even though the phrase you mentioned is from
Sure,
Grasshopper
sure.
Myth. I mentioned in the 1960s and 70s, if you asked a typical pastor what their church needed, they would probably use what I call revivalistic language.
Okay.
We need a revival. We need to have prayer meetings. We need to get on our knees before God. We went through the revivalist era in the 1960s and 70s. And I'm only going back as far as, the eras that I can remember personally that I lived through. So I remember that growing up. It was a revivalistic era. Then in the 80s, 90s, and 00s, we came into what I call the strategy era, where the
Yeah.
language shifted from revivalism conversation to management conversation. All of a sudden, we're reading books not just by Christian managers like John Maxwell, but we're also reading it from secular people and anything we could get our hands on. And quite often, when a pastor would recommend a book to other pastors, it might be from a non-Christian standpoint, like Peter Drucker, who's nothing that he says is anti-Christian necessarily,
Right.
but it's just general secular management stuff. So we moved into the management era. And during that time, I think we got to the point where we were spiritually managing people. We were thinking more about, what are the dynamics of a growing group of people and how, what percentage of them needs to be of this age and of that age? What percentage of them needs to be in small groups? What percentage of them need to be on ministry teams? And when our entire process is about metrics and percentages rather than knowing individual names, then we're really at a point where we're kind of spiritually managing people.
Yeah.
And out of that management era, we created the most managed and sold to generation in human history. And I think people now are sophisticated enough that they recognize when something is being sold to them and when they're being manipulated and managed.
Sure.
So not everybody, we're no, no nobody's wise enough, and every once in a while we all slip up and don't realize it. But I think there's a greater awareness of that now than ever. And so people really don't want to be just a number on a sheet and being spiritually managed. They really want to be pastored. And the word pastor, of course, in scripture comes from the word shepherd. They want a shepherd who knows them, who loves them, who cares for them. And if you take a look at Ephesians, the only place in the New Testament where the word pastor is even mentioned, the pastors, along with evangelists, prophets, teachers, and apostles, are given one assignment, and it's to equip God's people for works of ministry. So the call of the pastor is to equip the saints, not just to do all the ministry for them and not to manage them into some kind of a corporate place, but in fact to know them and to love them and to care for them. So when you're to say you're actually pastoring someone means you actually have to know their names, you have to be a part of them. So do we have pastors of ultra large churches where they can't know even 90% of their names? Sure. But they're really actually managing a group of pastors. If the big church is healthy, you've got pastors under them who are leading small groups and ministry teams, and
Sure.
that's where the actual pastoring is taking place. And any pastor of a large, healthy megachurch acknowledges that when they say phrases like, we want to grow bigger and smaller at the same time, because they know the actual hands-on pastoring isn't taking place by them. They're leading people who are pastors underneath them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think of just what a good reinforcement that is, because I do think it's a struggle. I recommend a lot of books, and for sure the secular business mixes in with kind of these books about followership and shepherding and what's the percentage there of just what our intake is. So this next question, and this kind of takes it a step further, right? Because not only is this pastor not this detached manager in a small church, but they really are a shepherd. But also, especially in a small church, the pastor functions just as much as a member of said community and not just as someone who sits atop that organizational structure. And so the idea of kind of pastor as church member, I think is really important to a small town church. How does a pastor, I mean, first of all, what is this kind of idea? And how do we live out this idea? How do we lean into it as a strength, you know?
Yeah, I want to approach it from two aspects, one for the health of the pastor and one for the health of the church. First, for the health of the pastor, virtually every survey that they've done of this about pastoral health, they've discovered that a vast majority of pastors are not attending and worshiping at a church like they recommend every single one of their members should do. When they're at church, they're working. And how are they being pastored? How are they being ministered to? Where is their place to unburden themselves and just simply relax and not be, and I get it. As a pastor, I know what it's like to really be fully engaged in a worship service just before I preach and to really be inspired and to really have the Lord touch me. And that's not that it's not that you're not being fed into by that. But when it is the same service that you're preaching in, let's all be honest, you leave having expended more spiritual energy than receiving of it. And too many of us ended in a place where we're spiritually and emotionally depleted because we're not finding avenues to be pastored, to be led, and to just spend time in worship before the Lord other than in a time of output. So receiving the input, being a church member, being a part of a body, and having that body minister to you emotionally and spiritually is just as important as what you're going to do in output. So that's the first thing for the health of the pastor. The second thing for the congregation is the smaller a church is, one of the big distinctions between the way small churches and big churches operate is about how the pastor manages their time and how the pastor leads the church. And here's the primary difference. In a small church, the smaller the church is, the more the pastor leads by their presence. So let's say in a church of 50, give or take 50, a pastor's going to lead by their presence. They know everyone and they're at every meeting and there's a constant pastoral presence and that's where their leadership takes place. When it gets to about a medium-sized church, the pastor still knows all the regulars and is at all the main meetings and is still leading from pastoral presence. But when a church gets to be large and super big, the pastor is no longer leading from pastoral presence. They have to learn how to lead in their absence. Because when a church gets big, they know fewer and fewer members of the congregation until it hits a point at 500 or 600 where they know fewer people than they don't know. And then when you get into the thousands, you're down into single digits of the percentage of church members that the pastor can even say by name, let alone spend any time with. So what they have to do is they have to learn how to entrust the hands-on pastor stuff that we talked about already to under shepherds, to under pastors, because they have to learn how to pastor in absence. And so that's one of the important things to understand as a, if you're pastoring in a smaller congregation is most of the pastoral instruction we receive comes from a big church standpoint. And so they're teaching how to pastor in absence because that's what they have to do. And most of the skills that we as small church pastors have to master are how to pastor in pastoral presence. And it's a different set of skills.
Man, I know that I'm preaching to the choir here, but it just this light bulb comes on in my brain of like how nice it is to just be seen, to not feel like you have this internal struggle of like, all I'm doing is pastoring my presence when all the resources I'm getting are telling me to do the opposite. And like how validating that can be to be like, oh, maybe I'm not screwed up, maybe I'm not wrong, maybe I'm not, maybe I'm experiencing frustration because I'm trying to put that square peg into a round hole. That's really that's really phenomenal.
In fact, there is even some teaching recently that I've heard by some people who do some really good stuff, by people who are friends of mine actually, who talk about, Pastor, you're probably the one hindering the growth of the church because you want to keep being a hands-on pastor. And I'm like, But maybe that's not a problem. Maybe that's what they're called to do, and maybe that's what that church needs. Not every church is supposed to scale up so big that the pastor can't be a hands-on pastor anymore. That's just simply not how the church has ever been, and I don't believe that's not how it's supposed to be. I believe most churches are small because most churches are supposed to be of a size where the pastor can do a hands-on pastoring because that's what they're called to do. So don't shy away from it. Learn how to do it better.
Well, let's talk a little bit about that. One of the big principles I think that affects longevity in the rural church, right? And again, I'm going to tap into a cycle that I know you've witnessed, that I've witnessed, where somebody comes into a setting, and a lot of, I mean, if we're honest, obviously there's a lot of unhealthy large churches, but especially in the rural context, there are a lot of times you roll into a small town church, and it can feel like you have all these big ideas, new ideas, ways you want to take the church. And it feels like all you're doing is hitting resistance. You know, it's a very common story for a pastor to say, well, I came and I wanted the church to be like this, like this, like this. They did not rise to that occasion. We started having conflict. I left disappointed. They left disillusioned. And like it all comes apart. And so when I read these words that you mentioned in the grasshopper myth, you talked about pastoring the church you have, not the church that you wish you had. And I, again, just had this like watershed understanding where I was like, yes, like that is the tension that we are hitting on a daily basis, is this whole like, I'm called to shepherd you, to take you to a better place, and yet you are who you are. And like, where is that at? And so just talk about that struggle, you know, kind of how do you do that, you know?
The phrasing of that actually came from as a counter to a lot of the teaching that I heard for a decade or more, in which church growth leaders would say, pastor the church you want to have, as
Sure,
like it
if you
was,
want to be a church of 300, build it that way, and then it'll eventually grow to 300, you know, or whatever.
Pastor, if you've got 50 people, but you want to be a church of 300, pastor it like it's a church of 300, and lo and behold, it'll be 300. I did that, and it didn't work. So,
That's a good
how do you
thesis statement
know?
for a lot of your books. I
Yeah,
did that, and it didn't work.
it is. It is. People ask, how did you get into this small church ministry? And my answer is, I tried to build a big church and failed. That's step one. Step two, I realized, hey, we've actually got a really good small church. Let's lean into
It's actually
that.
a killer riches to rags story is what I call it. I'm just kidding. I'm
Yeah,
just
pretty
kidding.
much. Pretty much, but how can we mend these rags to make them work for us? In a lot of ways, that's really it. So yeah, so the idea of let's take a typical church of 50, because 50 is a pretty normal sized church in the US. And so people say, pastor it like it's a church of 100 or 200. If you do that, you're going to distance yourself from your people, because again, the larger a church gets, the more the pastor pastors from their absence than their presence. So if you're going to pastor a church of 50 like it's a church of 200, you are going to absent yourself from the people that you're pastoring, because that's what pastoring a church of 200 looks like. You've got more absence going on. When you do that, you distance yourself and you're not doing the job you're called to do. So here's my recommendation, and I'm not the only one who says something like this. Pastor, if you're pastoring a church of 50, pastor it like it's a church of 50. Pastor it appropriate to its size. But while you're doing that, put processes and systems in place for a church of double that size. So you're not going to pastor it like it's a church of 100. You're going to pastor it like it's a church of 50, but you're going to begin to develop systems and processes and programs that would suit a church of 100. And that's for two reasons. One, if the Lord does give you numerical increase, you will then be able to handle it because you've got processes in place for 100. Two, if the numbers don't come, which most of the time they don't, okay, most of the time, even when you set up the systems, the numbers do not magically appear. Okay. But even if the numbers don't appear, if you are pastoring a church of 50 and you have systems in place for a church of 50, you're running at 100% all the time, and that's not sustainable. But if you're pastoring it like it's a church of 50, but your systems can handle 100, you're building margin into your life, into the church's life, into the way you disciple people, into the way you manage the systems. That gives you the chance to, I don't know, take a 2-week vacation and actually turn off your phone, because you know the church can manage without you because you set up a system that allows for that to take place. So manage for your current size. I mean, pastor for your current size, set up systems for double your size. And whether the numbers come or not, it'll give you margin and it will make you and the church healthier.
Yeah, wow. 'Cause I mean, again, the goal is to create healthy, long-term good things, you know? And like, it doesn't matter if growth happens or not in that sense, numerically. It just matters that, like, you know, you can still get burned out running at 100% capacity. Like, that's the point, you know?
Yep.
It's that running at 100% all the time makes burnout. And so it's just, so
Yeah.
I think that's huge wisdom. I really love that. And I think, again, it allows there to be a separation, because I think the distinction that's not mentioned as often is we would lump those two together, run the whole operation like it's a church of double your size, when in reality, you're saying, hey, we can have systems, but pastoring stays like it is. And it creates less offense. You know, small town's a place where people are sometimes offended by the formalities of a large system. And yeah, I'm sure we'll get into more of that. But let's do this. Switching gears to your next book here.
Sure.
We're just going to start to explain the concept of desizing, kind of your core idea of this Desizing the Church book. My biggest takeaway, and really, I mean, if I'm reading your book right, I think one of the biggest measurements was saying, how do we measure success? Is the way we measure success adequate? You know, and so talk us through that concept of desizing, and just, yeah, like where that came from, where it's at now, what are the big ramifications of it? Just walk us through that.
Yeah, actually, the word desizing is a term I made up because the idea that I had behind it, I couldn't find a word that described it. So if you can't find a word, you just make it up. You know, all words have been made up by
It's very
somebody.
Apostle
So
Paul of you, really. It's just,
yeah,
that
here we
guy
go.
took
Thank
Greek for a spin, you know. He took it for a joyride, you know. So
Yeah, there we go. So I'm doing the same with English. So I made up the word desizing. So desizing is not downsizing, because I don't think churches should be small. I think small churches should be great. And it's not right sizing, because I don't think there's any right size for a church. But my definition of desizing is not even to stop using numbers or size, but let's stop using it as the primary way that we judge whether or not a church is healthy. Let's put metrics and size in its proper place as one of many factors that we use to measure and assess the health, vitality, and effectiveness of a congregation. So right now, and for the last my entire time in ministry, over 40 years, the size of the church has been the primary and sometimes the exclusive way we have measured whether or not a church is healthy and effective. And so think about it. How often do we talk about, you know, so 70% of our churches are stuck. And what do you mean by stuck? What they mean is they haven't had a numerical increase in X period of time. And there's
Yeah.
no other factor in that other than the number of people sitting there on a Sunday morning. It is literally the only number that we're using. So we've got to desize. We've got to stop using the idea that bigger is better has to be removed from our vocabulary.
Yeah, and obviously, and we'll kind of address this more on the next question. But again, you know, I think of that Albert Einstein quote that's been, you know, said ad nauseum, but the whole, like, if you judge a fish by its ability to climb a tree, it will spend its whole life thinking it's stupid. And I know
Yeah.
for me, like, how much life does a statement like that give, where it says, hey, let's put these back in their proper place. Let's stop making it the only thing we talk about when we come to a conference. Yeah, no, I think that's a really powerful principle. So going into, and I picked this quote because obviously there's probably paragraphs around this, but I loved it because it was such strong language. But you said the pursuit of bigness in the church is morally, theologically, and emotionally damaging. Love that energy. Very much stick a flag in the ground, and say, hey, I believe this strongly. And so obviously we've got this definition of desizing in our back pocket saying, hey, we're starting to redefine success. But that is a strong statement, Pastor Carl. And so talk us through it. What does it mean? Why such, you know, intensity about it? Like, give us some
Yeah.
context.
Yeah, first of all, about the idea of strong statements, and there are some pretty bold statements in the book. One of the things I love about writing, I love speaking too, but one of the things I love about writing is if you write something bold and it turns out to be stupid, you can change it before you hit the publish button.
Sure.
But if you say something and you've said it's out there.
Yeah.
Like I've said stuff and later on gone, man, even I don't even agree with myself on that one. That was dumb.
Sure.
So when you're writing, you can put it out there. You can let it sit for a while. You can come back and visit it and go, that is bold, but do I still stand by it? And this is one of those things that I absolutely stand by, the pursuit of bigness. So the bigness, first of all, that's another term I need to define here. You know, bigness does not mean that the church gets big or anything gets big. Getting big is not a problem at all. But this obsession with size, this obsession with I have to get bigger year from this time this year to this time next year, or I've failed. That chasing of numbers is a very, very dangerous thing. First of all, it's morally compromising, it's theologically compromising, and it's emotionally damaging. So let me walk you through the three words. First of all, morally. Think about this. When you create higher stages under brighter lights with bigger microphones, you attract people who want to be on higher stages under brighter lights with bigger microphones.
Sure.
You attract
Makes
narcissists.
sense. Yeah.
Yeah. Now, not everybody on a high stage with a bright
Sure,
light
sure.
with a big microphone is a narcissist, but you're going to have a higher percentage because that's what they want. You're creating an appeal for narcissism. So we have to be very careful when we're growing things bigger that pulls people in that. Well, that's actually the emotional part of it. I'm working this backwards. So that's the emotionally, you're going to pull narcissists in. Morally, then you've got a problem because when the size of the thing, and in this case, the thing is the church congregation, when the size of the church congregation becomes about the only thing that matters, we will often compromise ourselves morally in order to get there. I mean, just think about everybody listening. How many times have you heard a phrase like, yeah, that church, they seem a little theologically off to me, but look at all the people coming. The Lord must be doing something there.
Yeah, there's very much the you know we I mean, I think obviously the quintessential example people are going to point to was that groundbreaking podcast, The Rise and Fall of Mars Hill. You know, and one of the reiterated themes of that entire podcast was, when did we decide that the ends would justify whatever means we do in the middle? And it's like, does God not have the right to sanctify both the results and the process?
So it's tempting to compromise our morals and to compromise our theology when we're chasing numbers. Now, that does not mean that big churches are necessarily likely morally or more morally or theologically compromised than small churches, because small church pastors can be just as enamored by chasing bigness. They're just not succeeding at it.
Sorry, I was really convicted with, you know, because it is true that when you write about small church, what I really loved about just your authorship, and this is a shameless plug for the things you've written, which is part of the point of the podcast, but I for sure was so convicted. Which, number one, I think you write very well because you weren't demonizing big churches, and I loved that approach because I do think sometimes when you tend towards one camp, you can just naturally say, well, the other one's got to be doing it wrong. And I've encountered that a ton. I mean, I think if you're a big church, you say, well, these small churches got to be failures, and if you're a small church, you say, well, then the big church has to be sinning. But I was very convicted because you know, in the middle of one of these chapters, you said, hey, I know small town churches aren't boasting about the 5,000 people that were in their pews, but they might tell you, oh, well, 90% of my town, you know, comes to my whatever. And it's like they start measuring by percentage of impact. And I was just a little frustrated because I had definitely stood up utilizing those metrics. And of course, I mean, you know, the sword of the spirit divides our heart, but there was probably some sincerity in that of just a reflection on what the Lord had done. But there was a little bit of that sneaky pride where I was like, we're measuring success by the same broken system, even if it's different, you know? So
I
sorry,
agree. And
continue on.
no, and no, to add to that, and there's nothing wrong with noting that as part of a fuller conversation about the health and effectiveness of a congregation. So if you've got a congregation in a small town that happens to be reaching 50% of their community in one way
Yeah,
or
big
another,
deal. Yeah.
it's a big deal and it should be mentioned, but it shouldn't be the only thing that's mentioned. It's not the primary deal. Tell me some stories. Tell me who these people are. Tell me about what the how the spiritual temperature of the community has changed, rather than just simply the percentages. I don't have a problem with the church is this big or the church grew from this small to this big. Absolutely, I want to hear that, but as a part of a much, much bigger picture rather than as the entire picture.
Yeah. So again, any more thoughts on that whole pursuit of bigness statement before we move on?
No, I think that does it. The challenge with it is, again, big size does not have a moral factor to it. A big church is not more compromised. A small church is not settling for less. big, small, it's a morally neutral thing. It's a theologically neutral thing. So when we start making it our goal rather than a one of multiple factors that we take a look at, then it's very easy to become emotionally, theologically, and morally compromised. So just rem that's one of the reasons that I push the size thing so strongly, because my heart breaks when I see any pastor, a small church pastor who leaves ministry, even though the church is healthy, simply because it didn't get bigger. I almost left pastoral ministry because my
Right.
church wasn't getting bigger. And it's not because I was chasing the numbers, it's because I was being told all healthy things grow. And if my church isn't growing, then it must not be healthy. I must be missing something. I must be screwing up. Maybe I'm not a good pastor.
Yeah.
So the small church pastor can be under the same delusion. And once I removed this idea that big that size is in any way a measure of effectiveness or of theological soundness or of health, once that was removed, then I could be the size we could be the size we were and be a healthy and strong and effective church at the size we are. And that's why this whole idea of removing size as the primary factor is so important for us.
Absolutely. Hello, everybody. Thanks for tuning into part one of a conversation with pastor and author Carl Vaters. So far in this story, we've been able to dive into some of the basic principles from his book, The Grasshopper Myth, and we're just excited to discuss really his whole content of what it means to desize the church, to kind of measure success differently. And next week, part two is going to have some of the same great content. I mean, this guy is chock full of wisdom. You don't want to miss it. As always, we hope you leave this podcast encouraged and inspired. We want you to know that we're not just speaking to the small church and the rural church, but really we want it to be spoken by people who understand where you're at. As always, you can find this podcast on formal channels like Spotify or Apple Podcast, but really word of mouth's a great way to get this podcast out there, just to invite another rural leader into that space. And so we're excited to see you again next week. I've been your host, Joe Epley. He has been pastor and author Carl Vaters, and we'll see you soon.